Colonel Lee Ellis is a retired U.S. Air Force colonel. He's originally from Commerce, Georgia, suburb of Atlanta. He's a graduate of the University of Georgia, as well as the Armed Forces Staff College and the Air War College. He's the author of numerous books on leadership and career development. Colonel Ellis served almost 25 years with the U.S. Air Force. As a fighter pilot, he was shot down, and from November 7, 1967, until March 14, 1973, that's 6 years, Colonel Ellis was a Vietnam POW. Same time and with Senator John McCain. Colonel Ellis described that experience as moments of boredom interrupted by stark moments of terror. For his service to our country, he's received many honors, including 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legion of Merit Awards, a Purple Heart, and numerous other things. He's the founder and president of Leadership Freedom and Freedom Star Media. He's a consultant now, speaks in the areas of leadership, team building, and human performance. He's had the privilege over the years, since his military service, of working with many large organizations. He resides in Atlanta with his wife, Mary. Mary, are you here? Mary, would you do me a favor and stand, please? Would you thank Mary for being here? They have 4 children and 6 grandchildren. Would you do me a favor and stand to your feet? And welcome to our platform, Colonel Lee Ellis.
Thank you. Please be seated. Thank you. Please be seated. Wow, what an evening and what a wonderful crowd. And to be here with you all, Terrence, thank you so much for having me here. Mary and I are delighted. It's been a wonderful event so far, and we're looking forward to even more as we go through the next couple of days. You know, when I saw that video about next year's event, I had a flashback. I almost couldn't get up here and speak. I had PTSD hit me because here's an airplane on fire, out of control, and the guy's jumping out of it. That actually happened to me, by the way. I'll tell you a little bit about that. You know, this is my first FCCI conference, but my roots with FCCI go deep and long back. You see, when I retired from the Air Force in 1990, I went to work for Larry Burkett and Christian Financial Concepts. And so Larry and Judy were great friends of ours, and I heard about FCCI quite often. So tonight, and they're not all here, but I read Bobby's great book, enjoyed your book, Bobby. Thank you so much for what you've done there and for your leadership over the years. And Sue, I know you've been there every step of the way. Larry and Judy, Bobby Mitchell, I met more than 20 years ago. Thomas and Gwen Harris have been friends of ours for a long, long time. Terry and Paula Parker, Ron Blue, Ray Miller, Bill Leonard, and Susie. Susan, good to see you. Bob McCown's here from Nashville, Tennessee. Bob and I have known each other a long time. And the Maloons, I got to know the Maloons working with Larry. And more recently, Howard Dayton and David Ray. And there are probably some others, but those are the ones that jumped out of your book that I'd known from before. So it's an honor and a privilege to be with FCCI. And if you'd bring back up the lights, I can see these beautiful people really well, and that will be even better if you bring those lights back up. By the way, I am a control freak. Fighter pilots and surgeons quite often are, because we do life and death business. I'm a recovering control freak. And so it was at my request that table was moved, because I'm also a roamer. And I'm going to roam around some tonight. And the lights are coming up so that I can see your eyes. And there's Jim right over here. Jim was there also 20 plus years ago. And I met him, Jim Moy. Good to see you again. And I wish you could see me better. You know, speaking of seeing, Larry Burkett was always full of stories and quick witticisms. And he was talking about his ability to read the Bible and see all those financial principles. And he said, well, I'm not an expert, but in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man can be king. And he said that many times. Many of you remember that. Larry was really the common denominator for many of us in this room, and we sure miss him. Yesterday, Bobby talked about having a role model, his father. What a wonderful, wonderful thing to have a father as a role model. I'm going to tell you about one of my role models a little bit later. I have had a lot of them, wonderful ones through the years, but a guy named Captain Ken Fisher. You'll hear more about him. A friend, I had a great friend in Larry Burkett, and because of Larry, I'm here today. And a book. Now, the first thing that came to mind in the book was, of course, the Bible, but it was Charles Sheldon's book, which is helping us really understand Jesus and how he would live and what have us do. But my introduction to a book, this ADD kid who's kind of grown up and matured, sitting in the slammer for 5.5, 6 years. But my introduction was a book, was one day Larry Burkett walked into my office at Christian Financial Concepts and said, "Lee, how'd you like to write a book with me?" And I said, "Well, Larry, I don't have much else to do for the next few months. That's a good idea. Let's do it." I didn't know any better, you know. When he hired me, I didn't know I couldn't do, and I had no idea how long it was going to take to develop the career pathways and career assessment program. So because of Larry, we wrote a book together in 1993, Your Career in Changing Times. And because of computers, because I can't read my own handwriting, and Mary can't either, bless her heart, but because of computers and Larry Burkett, we wrote a book, and I got introduced to book writing, and now I've written several books, and I actually enjoy writing books. I had no idea until this friend stepped into my life and introduced that to me. The power of role models and friends in a book is big. Larry also said, "God owns it all, and we're just stewards." I heard him say that in 1983 when I was driving home from work. I was at the Air War College in Montgomery, Alabama, and they have that wonderful Christian radio station in Montgomery. And I was listening to it, and there was this guy named Larry Burkett talking about the Bible and money and all that, what God has to say about money. And I said, that really makes a lot of sense. It connected with me. And so I ended up becoming a teacher counselor for Christian Financial Concepts while I was still in the Air Force. And that's how I ended up working for Larry. Walt said yesterday, "You must believe. You must believe." I'm going to mention that again. But you must believe. What you believe, you must believe. And you must believe in it wholeheartedly. He also said, "You can win." Well, chapter 5 in my book, if you have your little handout there, everyone should have one on the table. The 14 principles, the 14 lessons in the book, chapter 5 is fight to win. And it was exactly what Walt was telling us about the other night. And if he hadn't been saying that for years, I would think he got a hold of my idea. But he's actually a coach, and he knows about fighting to win. Walt and David Green this morning, talked about leadership is about responsibility. Leadership is about serving. I couldn't agree more. You know, leadership always makes a difference. And for our next generation, the leaders in this generation are going to have to really do some mentoring and teaching, role modeling, developing. And more than that, we have a specific problem in our culture today that I've determined that the people of the type in this room are the only ones that can address this issue. The issue is our culture and what's happening to it. And I'm going to get to my story in a minute. But about 6 or 8 months ago, I'm driving down the road, and I'm going through things in my head about the culture, and I'm angry about a lot of the things that have happened in our culture. And my personality profile is not an impatient one, and it can get angry about things. And usually they're about godly things, and I try to handle them in a godly way, and don't always, but I try to. But I'm upset about our culture and what's happening, what our grandkids are going to inherit. And I went through my mind about who is going to turn around, who's going to step up, who's going to stand in the gap for the culture that we grew up with. And I said, it's not going to be the educators and the academics. They don't have much leadership to start with, and they don't believe, most of them don't believe the way we do. You know, and it's not going to be the media, same old. It's not going to be the government. And I hate to say it, but the families are not equipped really to do this much anymore either. The television and the screens and the divided families make it much harder. The church is not equipped, doesn't have the leadership, doesn't have the organization, doesn't have the power. God can do it. But as far as people walking this earth that are going to be the instruments, ladies and gentlemen, I submit to you that it's business leaders that can make the difference. We have the most vested interest in changing the culture back, the principles that we were founded on, than anybody else in this country. Because we need people of character in our companies. Toyota dealer from Alabama told me, my parts guy was stealing me blind and nobody even told me. The other guys knew it and didn't tell me. Okay? We need people of character in our businesses. You know that. And lots of them haven't been taught that. We need that free society. We need a culture where we can have a market economy and not shut down by the government and taxed to death. We need those kind of things. We need responsibility. We have the greatest felt need, the business company. We have the one with the most vested interest, and we have the leadership, we have the power, and we have the money. We got to think about how we're going to do it. Well, I think it has to start with us setting the example, and that's in leading with honor. And that's what I'm here to talk to you about tonight, leading with honor, and to share my story. You all have a story. And I hope that you will package your story, review it, and share it with the next generation and tell them why these things are important and how they've guided you and helped you along the way. Well, when I was 5 years old, I wanted to fly airplanes in the worst way because I climbed up on one in Athens, Georgia at the Veterans Park, and I said, this is me. This is where I belong. 3 days after I graduated from the University of Georgia in ROTC, I got my commission, and 3 days after that, I was in Valdosta, Georgia in flight school. My dream had come true. I showed up. I grew up on a farm out near Commerce. Actually, it was out in the boonies. I plowed mules. My brother milked a cow, and we both plowed mules, and I took care of the hogs and chopped the wood. We had a great life. Not much material things, but we had a lot of good food and a great Christian home foundation to grow up in with wonderful parents. My parents didn't really support me a lot about being a pilot, but they didn't try to slow me down either. 53 weeks after I got to Valdosta, I got my wings. So I went from plowing mules to flying supersonic jets in 5 years. That's a pretty exciting life. My assignment said F-4 Phantom, Pipeline, Southeast Asia. This is the F-4 Phantom. This is the hot rod of 1966. I graduated, got my wings August 6, 1966. I was still 22 years old, I think, at the time. And it was exciting because I'm getting my dream fulfilled. But it did say Pipeline, Southeast Asia. This was when the war was building up, and that meant we were going to go to war. But being young fighter pilot, that's what we do. And we're invincible. Total confident. So away we go to Southern California for our combat training. I did, and a bunch of my friends. And here we got to do the unimaginable. Fly at faster than 500 miles an hour, below 500 feet, through the desert, over the Sierras. You can see in the background there the picture. And it was everything they did in Top Gun, plus a lot of air to ground. So we were in high cotton. We were enjoying ourselves. It was great. But it was all for a purpose because we were going to go to war. I got to Da Nang at the end of June 1967, all trained up and ready to go. We all took a picture like this with all our gear on. That's a survival vest. And I got everything. I got everything from sewing needles and thread to compasses and water and all extra batteries in my radio, everything in that survival vest. It weighed about 20 pounds, packed full of stuff, ready to go, you know, in combat. These hero shots we sent home to Mom. I was single, hadn't met Mary yet, and sent home to Mom and Dad, and I still had some girlfriends out there round about, and I wanted to impress them, so I had to send them a picture and let them know I was thinking about them, you know. And At the top of this slide is chapter 1, principle 1, for leadership and life. Know yourself. You have to know yourself to manage yourself. Your strengths, your struggles, your passion, your purpose, your personality, your values. And when you know those and your work and your mission is aligned, you can be a Bobby Mitchell or a Jim Moy, a Larry Burkett, or a Lee Ellis and love what you do. And when things turn south and it gets tough, times get tough, when you're doing what you know God has called you to do, you can hang in there until a better day comes. So that's why I went to work for Larry Burkett, was to build a program to help teenagers know what they should do when they left high school. The old career pathways, which came to Career Direct and is still out there around the world. Know yourself. Really know yourself. Be authentic. Well, the 7th of November, my airplane was hit. It exploded. There were two of us in the F-4, and I'm Junior Birdman in the back seat, both pilots back then. The airplane blows up. It's tumbling. I know I've got to get out. Your worst personal and professional nightmare is to eject from an airplane over enemy territory where you're attacking gunners on the ground, and they're down there shooting at you, and you're going to come down right in the middle of the hornet's nest. And that's what happened. We were so well trained, and here's another point. In your organization, train people so they know how to perform, and especially in a crisis. They know what they're supposed to do to execute their mission. We were well trained. So I pulled that handle. In less than 2.5 seconds, that thing blasted me up the rails, seat and all. It's the way it's designed to do. Blows the canopy, blasts me up about 60 feet in the air. It automatically separates me from the seat. And as the seat goes one way and I go the other, it pulls the D-ring and deploys my parachute. In 2.5 seconds, I look up, check your parachute, item 1. Good parachute. Now I'm starting to think, where am I going to land? How am I going to evade capture? That's what I'm really thinking about. There's a lot of shooting on the ground, foreign language, da-da-da-da, screaming, gun commanders yelling at their gunners and all. I'm just thinking about how to evade. I'm still cool. Follow my training in the midst of that. I come down. I do my parachute landing fall. I pull up my radio. I call the wingman, say, I'm 200 meters north of the river. I'm headed south. You start strafing at 300. Well, after the war, I saw them at a fighter pilots reunion. They said, we heard your call, but we were afraid we couldn't shoot that good, so we didn't fire. We didn't strafe. And I said, probably very wise, because they were so close, and they captured me within a minute or two. The next 2 weeks, it took me to get to Hanoi. And you can read about that in chapter 1 if you want. We'll have books out here in the resource afterwards. But during that time, the thing that I really knew most was that God was in charge of my life. And even though, by the way, once they captured me, they stripped me down to my jockey shorts, and here I am, proud, world-famous fighter pilot. And I am humbled, I am terrified, I'm in shock. I am no longer operating on my training. I am in shock. And so the first thing I tried to do was started to gather myself and say, what's going on here? What do I need to do? How can I hang in there until it gets better? Maybe I get a chance to escape. That's what I'm hanging on to now. Before I get to Hanoi, maybe I can get a chance to escape. I'd gone through survival school, pretty well trained there. We kind of knew what to expect. Didn't have a good chance to escape. But during the trip to Hanoi, 3 times American air power bombed and strafed where I was. And every time, the North Vietnamese had this down. We'd been bombing up there a couple of years. They had me in foxholes and in bomb shelters, and they were jumping in with me. And it's pretty exciting on the receiving end of CVU-24s, Eric. You know about those. And bombs from 105s and so on. But that wasn't the most exciting thing. The most exciting thing was when the local populace, you know, those farmers, they were not too excited to see me. Or maybe they were excited because they wanted to kill me. Because we'd been bombing up there, and you can imagine what redneck farmers would be like in Georgia if Russians had been strafing them for 2 years, and blowing up their trucks and wagons. They were coming after me. And I had a very honorable, good, probably a staff sergeant in charge of taking me north, and he had a squad of soldiers with AK-47s. And this guy had some money to buy our food, and he was had been told to get me to a drop-off station further north, and they protected me. And they got beat up sometimes protecting me. They would put a cordon of rifles around me and push through the crowd. And it was just like something in the old movies, you know, the crowd is coming in. At the last minute, the hero gets yanked away and rides away on his horse. And they threw me in the truck and we went bouncing out of there. Three or four times in villages this happened. So I'm still alive. And kind of like Ronald Reagan, of course, this is before Ronald Reagan, but like he said later when he got shot, I knew for sure that God wasn't through with me yet. He had a purpose for my life. I always had believed that. I always had known God loved me. I'd seen that many times in my life already before. And so my job now is to hang on and live it out and to do my job, do my responsibility as a military guy in a difficult situation. Well, we got to the Hanoi Hilton. It's a complex that occupies an entire block. It's built in the 1890s by the French. It's all a prison. It's a Bastille prison. The walls are about 15 feet high, about 5 feet thick. There's guard towers at the corners, machine guns in them, electrical barbed wire, and embedded, concreted in, just solid broken glass bottles around the top. Nobody ever escaped from that prison. The Hanoi Hilton, we stayed mostly in that top left-hand quadrant called Little Vegas. You have to name things, and many fighter pilots had gone through Las Vegas for training, so that's what they named it. Well, the enemy had goals to break us, to get military information, compliance, and to make propaganda. It was a propaganda war. They wanted us to help. They wanted to indoctrinate the POWs and get our willful cooperation. Well, we're just the opposite. Our goal is to live up to the code of conduct, to resist the enemy, to stay loyal to our fellow POWs, to keep faith with our country and its allies, and to minimize loss to the U.S. And ultimately, I know all of y'all have a mission, vision, value statement. We had the all-time best because we had mission, vision, and values in three words: return with honor. We wanted to go home desperately, but with honor. And so that's where the battle was going to be, their goals and our goals. And every day, the first few years was a battle. The good thing was, we as fighter pilots, we think positive. We always think we can handle it. We believe we can. And most of the time, through that commitment and our training, we can. So we had to stay positive. I went to a 6.5 by 7 foot cell there at the tip of that Red Arrow. 6.5 feet, that's about 8 inches wider than that and about 16 or 15 inches wider than that. About the size of a walk-in closet or a gas station in 1955 in Commerce, Georgia. We were in there for the next 9 months, and it wasn't just me. There were three other guys, four of us in this 6.5 by 7 foot cell for the next 9 months. It was about the size of a bathroom, and it was our bathroom. We had a 3-gallon bucket, and thank goodness it had a lid. It was our bedroom, our dining room, our living room, and everything for the next 9 months. You do what you have to do to survive, and you try to stay positive during that time. Lieutenant Commander Red McDaniel, retired Navy captain now, he's in his early 80s. What a wonderful, courageous Christian man. Great book he wrote after the war. But he said, all I had was tomorrow, and that was the height of optimism. Well, then I would make tomorrow count for something. And on that note, I finally found sleep. And one of my cellmates, Jim Warner, said quite often at night as we'd head in, he'd say, tomorrow's another day. Tomorrow's another day. Isn't it wonderful to go to sleep and say your prayers and thank the Lord for the day and know that tomorrow's another day and you can start over again? Well, when you're a POW, sleep is the opium of the POW. And anytime you can check out in the POW camp, it's a good thing. We learned we had to guard our character. Now, we talked about the gentleman just prior to me was talking about character first. It is first because it's who you are. And we learned that some people didn't have good character. In fact, one of my cellmates was one of the few, the 1% out of over 500 of us that didn't have good character. Because when the going got tough, he rationalized. He had the opportunity, he had the need, because he was scared. And even though he was a lieutenant colonel and I was a first lieutenant, and we had a captain, a first lieutenant, another first lieutenant, he started collaborating with the enemy. And so one day when he was out of the cell in the interrogation, Captain Ken Fisher, who was the next ranking guy in the cell, said, "Guys, he's violating the code of conduct. He's collaborating with the enemy. I think I should relieve him of command and give him an order to cease collaborating. Will you support me?" In other words, we're going to mutiny. Will you support me? We said, absolutely, that's the right thing to do. So that's what he did when he came back to the room. And this lieutenant colonel, been in the military 16 years, said, "Well, you know, this is not a declared war. It's really every man for himself. The code of conduct doesn't apply." You can imagine how I felt as a first lieutenant. I just turned 24 years old hearing that. So I was glad that he was out of command, and we kind of checked out on him, and he checked out on us. We had to live with him about another 3 or 4 months. We separated, and we didn't see him again until the end of the war. Actually, I haven't ever seen him again in the reality since then. But this guy, role model, Captain Ken Fisher, he was a person of great character. Now, I'm sure he had done some wild and woolly things in his life, but this guy was a New York State wrestling champion in the 50s, okay? They were the best in the country pretty much back then in wrestling. He was a state champion. He wrestled collegiately at the University of Pennsylvania. But he wasn't just physically tough at 165 or 70 pounds. He was mentally tough, and his character was above anything I could imagine, because his word was his word, and he would risk everything. He would suffer to lead and be responsible for the rest of us in that cell. And he was my commander, senior ranking officer, for the next 3 years in the POW camps. And I grew up under him. I went from being a kid to being an adult, I think, under his maturity and his courage and his character. And that meant so much to me. To have somebody who's a role model. And I think about the role that you all play, you leaders out there in the audience. Somebody's watching you. Somebody's cueing off you how you're going to handle it. When we're in the POW camps, when you're 24 years old, you don't want to lead anything except the parade getting out of there, maybe. You don't want to lead anything else. You just want to follow somebody who's tougher than you are, who can pave the way and clear the field, so to speak, for you to come behind them. And I had such a guy as that in Ken Fisher. Competitive, fight to win, and deep character, and great courage. What a blessing that was for me. Well, we all had to confront our doubts and fears. We were all interrogated. We were all threatened with torture if we didn't give them what they wanted. Of course, we didn't, so 95% of us were tortured. I went through a couple of rounds of the lighter torture, I would say. I'll tell you about some of the heavy stuff here in a minute. But the point is, we had to look somebody in the eye and say no. I got called in one time, and the guy wanted me to tell him what I thought President Johnson's mistakes were. Well, by this time, I wasn't real pleased with President Johnson, because I'd been sitting there for a while, and he hadn't got me out of there. And not only that, but he said he wasn't going to run. I was dependent on him getting the war ended so I could, you know, so he could win the election and I'd get out of there. And he fooled me and left me sitting there. And not only that, but he stopped the bombing in Hanoi. So I wasn't too happy with him. And I said, I had to put on, I'm not an actor, but I put on an act. I scratched my head and I said, I can't think of anything he's done wrong. I don't disagree with him on anything. And the guy got all upset and he says, "You must write something. You must write something about the Vietnamese." So I wrote 4 sentences this day. This was after I had gone through a couple of things. I said, "I don't know much about the Vietnamese people, but what I have seen is that the women do most of the heavy work and the men don't do too much." Oh, he got so mad. He threw it down and had me put in handcuffs and taken back to my cell. never asked me to write again. But other times, it wasn't that easy. And we all had to learn to confront our doubts and fears. Now, if you ask me as a leadership consultant for 16 years, what is the biggest issue with leadership in this country today? I would say it's courage. People don't have the courage to do the right thing when it comes up. And I'll tell you, I struggle with this. I mean, I teach it. I live it to the best of my ability. But some days I got something to do and I find myself putting it off for a while because it feels uncomfortable and I got to make that phone call or go see this person. And I start catching myself procrastinating and backing up. And I have to coach myself. Okay, Lee, get a plan, get engaged, and confront it. Because it ain't going to get any better. It's just going to get worse. This will heal and take care of so many problems. And pretty soon you find out a lot of those things that you're uncomfortable about and you're scared about, they're straw men. They're not very powerful at all. They're not big. Confront your doubts and fears. Well, there was one guy over across the way. I finally was able to clear. There was one little window way up high, and it was covered with a tan mat. And I kept pushing on it till I could see behind it. And in there, I saw this guy one day. They had his shutters open. And I saw this guy, Colonel Robbie Reisner. I thought I recognized him because he looked old, old. Reisner was 43 then. He was really old. He had fought in Korea and had been an ace. He'd been on the cover of Time magazine. He was like the number one fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force. So we all kind of knew he was a legend. He really was a legend. But he was a senior ranking officer there and had been for 2 years, and he had been through hell. They found out he was leading and forming a military organization, and they beat him, and they tortured him, and they beat him, and they tortured him. And they put him, he had just come out of 10 months in a totally dark room where he had anxiety attacks, and now he's having all sorts of nightmares and screaming at night. But he was smiling and bouncing up and down, and we were able to communicate silently by spelling out letters, like this is your whiteboard and this is your marker, and just spelling out letters. Spell out words. He told me about being tortured in the pretzel. Pretzels, Mike? You didn't have any pretzels like this, I hope, in your pretzel store in South Carolina. Wrists tied, elbows tied till they touch, circulation cut off, ankles tied, one guy pushing from behind, one guy pulling from the front, heads down on the floor until everything is tearing loose under the shoulders. And then usually the feet and hands are tied together and you're just left in the pretzel. Excruciating, maddening. And then when the circulation comes back, the pain is ferocious. Reisner had already been through this 2 or 3 times. But here's what he said. He said, Lee, I'm in charge, and here's what I want you to do. This guy's been going through 2 years of that and bouncing back. Be a good American, live by the code of conduct, take torture, resist up to the point of permanent physical or mental damage, bounce back to resist again, stay united through communication, pray every day, go home proud, return with honor. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have an organization and you build a culture like the 3 or 4 major leaders in Vietnam built a culture that would stand up in the crucible of a POW camp, the culture that held us together, that aligned us towards the code of conduct, returning with honor, living up to our responsibility, these guys were fabulous. They built a culture. Clarify and build your culture, because your culture will hold people together. When you're not there to supervise them, they'll be doing, and we were often spread in different camps, sometimes in solitary confinement or groups, small groups. Our leaders didn't have access to us. We knew what to do because we knew what the culture was and we knew what was expected. And when he was in another camp or out of commission, out of communication, we had our number two guy. We had James Bond as our number two guy. James Bond Stockdale. That MOH beside his name stands for the Medal of Honor that he received, was awarded by Congress after the war, because Stockdale was one tough hombre. and he supported Reisner 100%, continued to build the culture. And when he was out of commission or in another camp, Denton was over in the zoo camp for a long time. These are all guys born in 1924, 1925. They came in the military at the end of World War II, 1945 and 46. Two of them are Naval Academy graduates. Reisner was the Air Force guy. And they're all tough as nails. They're old school. And they bounce back and bounce back. Denton was a very innovative communicator and a risk taker. And Denton was tortured to go into a press conference with a Japanese reporter. He gets in there. The lights are just like these lights in my eyes, except brighter because they were closer. And the reporter said, "Well, what do you think about your government's policy on the bombing?" And he said, "I've been here more than 2 years, and I don't know what my government's policy is on anything anymore. But whatever it is, I support it 110%. In your face." Well, rather than lose face, they let him stay in the press conference, and the reporter asked him about his food and shelter and so on. And in the face of these lights, Denton is going like this, and all of a sudden, he starts blinking Morse code, and he blinks, T-O-R-T-U-R-E, twice. The American intelligence agencies, of course, saw it and said, "Why is he blinking? What's he doing?" And one guy said, "That's Morse code. You know, T, I used to remember that. What is it? Da-da-dit? Anyway, they got it, the message. If he had been caught, they probably would have killed him because it would have been such a loss of face. They never found out about that, fortunately. Well, we had these three great leaders, this triumvirate of leaders that was so senior and so experienced and so courageous and so competent, it made all the difference in the world for us. It made a huge difference. And they all had different leadership styles. They had different personalities. You got Stockdale on one side there on the right, who's an introvert and a stoic. You got Denton on the left side, who's an extrovert and an optimist over the top sometimes, which irritated Stockdale occasionally that Denton would be so optimistic. And you got Reisner kind of in the middle. Three different leadership styles, but character, courage, and competence, they were just alike. And it made a huge difference for us. Leadership always makes a difference. Well, we had to communicate, and one of the guys brought in with him the tap code, because you can't tap dots and dashes for Morse code. And in World War II, he had heard in the survival school that in World War II, they tapped on the pipes from one building to the other. And this guy is the only one that caught up with the sergeant instructor after his class and said, "By the way, how do you tap dots and dashes?" And the guy said, "Oh, man, I forgot to tell you. It wasn't Morse code. It was a tap code, a 5x5 matrix. There are 26 letters in the alphabet. You leave out one letter. Now you got 25. And you put them in a matrix of pigeonholes, and you always go down and then across. You go down first and then across." So our guys chose to omit the letter K and use C for K. So to say hi, you go down 2 and over 3, and then down 2 and over 4. Well, we had plenty of time to practice. And for all you young people that are so cool with your shortcuts, we had shortcuts 25 years before cell phones. That was TT. When was WN? And every night at the end of the day, the last communication would be, GBU. God bless you. That was the way we signed off. And most of us still sign off our emails GBU today. Over-communicate the message. It's so hard to communicate and get clarity. Somebody mentioned clarity yesterday. Oh, it's on Daniel Harkavy's video on your website. He talks about clarity. Clarity is so important, leaders. Get clarity. Make sure the people at the bottom are getting clarity about your organization and what your beliefs are, what your policies are. Push it down and then check to make sure they're getting the same message. You have to over-communicate. You have to clarify, we tapped on the wall. This is in the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Vietnam POW Museum there. It's a full, actual 6.5 by 7 or so cell. Two guys tapping back and forth. You have to collaborate and you have to cover each other. When you're alone and you're hurting, you need somebody to come alongside and say, hey man, we're with you, we're proud of you. Hang in there, we're going to get out of here someday. That was so powerful. One guy, you have to innovate. One guy and his cellmate, one afternoon, they moved to a new camp and they saw another building about 20 yards away and they couldn't yell out, they couldn't tap, and they climbed up over the wall and they got these other guys, they saw some other guys looking over the wall when the guards weren't around, and they sat down and figured out how to do this in one afternoon. They could say hi, just like that. That quick, that silent, and it was fast. TD, we, GOT, P, K, G, S, period. We could punctuate. We didn't get a letter. I wrote my first letter at 2 years, got my first one at 2.5, and got my first package, 6-pound package, about 3 years. And we get one every 3 or 4 months, 6 months, something like that. Not a lot of communication. Leadership always makes a difference. And I have to tell you about James Bond's lady. You know, James Bond's always famous for the women around him. Well, James Bond Stockdale was famous for one faithful, loyal woman, Sybil Stockdale. And after several years of being quiet, the government told our families, y'all don't be quiet. Don't make a big deal about it. Just keep, don't tell anybody. Don't mention your husband's POW. You know, talk to us, but don't talk to the press. Don't mention it. And after several years of that, it wasn't working. And she and some other family members, wives, decided they need to get organized and they need to get a movement going. And so Sybil Stockdale, living on Coronado Island in San Diego, got some groups together, and they formed some others around the country, and she was elected chairman of the board and president and so on. The rest of the story, though, is that she moved to Washington, D.C. so she could be near the center of power. She met with President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, and in a nice, smiling way, said, here's the deal. Your plan's not working. We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to get outrageously loud about our men. So you have a choice, gentlemen. You get on the float with us, or you can be on the outside and who knows what tomatoes might be thrown your way. Basically, what she said. And the government changed its policy. Over the next 2 or 3 years, millions of letters. The lady on the right there, Phyllis Scolani, who died in May unexpectedly. We were in Arlington for a funeral a few weeks ago. She got 1 million letters from the state of Virginia, written to the communist delegation from Vietnam in Paris. And they dumped all those letters out, and they had the media there taking pictures of it. And all those pictures got back to Hanoi. And then Ho Chi Minh dies in the fall of 1969. And new leadership comes in power. And you know what they decided? They didn't like that bad publicity. They went to good publicity about how bad the U.S. was, and they didn't like it. And you know what they did? They came in one day a few months later and they stopped all the torture. They increased the food, they opened the shutters, and we got to see outside and see some sunlight. Leadership always makes a difference. Those families who took to the pavement and got all these posters made up, and got all those letters written, and went to Paris. Ross Perot paid for a lot of them to go over there. Flew them over there. They met and got confronted those delegation. They got their attention. They changed. They changed our world. People connected at a heart level. As a leader, you need the head knowledge. You need the tough stuff. But you got to connect at a heart level. That's what inspires people. That's what motivates people to come to work. They want to feel part of something. They want to feel valued. They want to know you care about them. I loved hearing about David Green's company. You know, they take care of the people. They got all clinics for them. People know they care about them. See? It makes a difference. Develop your people. Our leaders, my leader in Building 3, this was after a raid, and we were back in a room with 55 guys in there. John McCain was in Building 1, had about 40 in there, and about 45 in Building 2. These are actually rooms. We call them Room 2, Room 3. All the way around, Building 7 had a bunch of senior officers in it. real senior, and they had about 45 in there. So there's about 330 of us in this one compound, all of us really, after the raid at Sante. And our commander in our room three called a guy who'd only one who'd really been an educator. He got recalled as a reservist. He said, "Tom, we need an education program, and you got 2 weeks to put it together. Now figure it out." So Tom found a piece of broken brick, a brick tile, and went over and wrote on the slab floor a bunch of subjects. He took a survey. He asked everybody to come by and mark with which classes they'd like to study. And within 2 weeks, we had classes going. We had the Monday, Wednesday, Friday classes, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday classes, 3 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon. We'd go 8 weeks on, take 2 weeks off, 8 weeks on, 2 weeks off. I studied Spanish, French, and German. I'd had French in college. I was a terrible French student. So I was studying intermediate French and teaching basic French, studying Spanish. My goal was to get fluent in Spanish and French and have a 2,000-word working vocabulary. The good news is I accomplished all my goals. The bad news is I was there long enough to accomplish all my goals. They developed us. It was amazing. I actually learned differential calculus with a piece of broken brick over here on the corner of that floor. Be resilient, bounce back. We kept bouncing back. We kept bouncing back. And year after year, and one day, the war ended. And they said, "You're going to go home and groups every 2 weeks over the next 60 days. This is the third big group, March 14th, 1973. And this was a little, you know, like the airport shuttle buses to go to the hotels. We rode out, and John McCain was captured 11 days prior to me. So we're in the same little group, and there's John on the front row, and there's yours truly with his mustache. I grew my going-home fighter pilot mustache back there about three rows behind him. We flew home all the way together. We got on that airplane, and we were so excited, but it was not over till it's over. Once we got airborne, you see Ken Fisher on the left, me in the middle, and John McCain on the right in those arrows. And once we got airborne, we started cheering and stomping, and then we got over international waters. We really cut loose because now we know we're really free. Free the captives. Those people who work for you that don't think they're much, they're in shackles. All of us in shackles. We all got baggage. Encourage them. Develop them. Free them to be all they can be. This is about a few seconds of my release, and then I'll summarize, and we'll be finished. This is March 14th, and they gave us going home clothes that day. We're starting to get excited, but we're holding our emotions because we don't want to be disappointed. We don't want it to go south. We're on the airplane now, flying back. We're over international water, and they passed out cigarettes and cigars, and I lit up my celebration cigar, and we're feeling good here, and it's really going to happen. We're going to go home. We're on our way home. We land at the Philippines. We spend 2 days in the hospital getting checked over real quick. We get our uniform, and now we're just got from the hospital. We got off the bus. We're about to get on a C-141 and fly home. We salute the captain, the colonel, and the two-star general. And then there's a bunch of families all around the rope over there, and they are hugging us and giving us gifts and presents. And we had no idea what we were going to come home to. We thought we'd just come home and that'd be it. But there were actually people there cheering for us on the base. This was at the base. And, you know, a lot of them wanted to hug us. And since we hadn't seen any women in 5.5 years and hadn't had any hugs, we hugged them all. The two nurses on my flight, they just kind of, guys lined up, and they just went around and hugged them like this, you know. So it was kind of an exciting day. And on the way home, we refueled for a couple of hours, just landed real quickly in Hawaii. Landed in Montgomery, Alabama, which is the nearest big major Air Force hospital to home. And we came home with honor. A little dented. A little scratch. Thank you. Thank you. But here are the people that really deserve the honor. It was my parents, my brother and his family, and the people that had been working with them for our release. But the parents, my mother and father, had gone through the worst, as you can imagine. They didn't know for sure I was alive for a year or so. They knew I was alive when I hit the ground, but they didn't know I was a POW for quite a while. And they had toughed it out and made it through. And, you know, they trusted God. They really did, and that was powerful. And the prayers of our community, the prayers of people around the world really made a difference. Went back to Commerce, Georgia. They had a parade. Most Vietnam veterans, I know there's some in the room tonight, and I'm so sorry you didn't get an honorable return home. The POWs did because the war was over, and we had a lot of people that had been wearing bracelets for us in places like Commerce, Georgia. Ugly little town, but beautiful people. They had a parade, and I was the only one in the parade. And we'd drive up about 10 feet, and I'd stop and shake hands with a bunch of people. And, hey, J.D., hey, Tom. And finally somebody said, how do you remember everybody's name? And I said, I haven't met hardly any new people in 6 years. I've been thinking about you guys, which was true. Back to work, I decided I wanted to go back and continue my flying. The Air Force offered me an opportunity to go back to requalify. I went right back to it. Fortunately, my skills were good enough. I went right, picked it up quickly, and did that for a number of years. We believed. We had faith. Faith in God was so important up there. We'd ask for a Bible every week, and they'd say, no, we don't even have one. Of course, they had stacks of them. Our families had sent them. But faith in God was so important. Faith in ourselves and each other. Faith in our families. Faith in our country that they would someday get us out. And faith that we could do it, that we could hang on and someday go home with honor. And so that belief and that faith, day by day, we made it. The lessons for today, character. Know yourself. You got to know yourself to manage yourself, and you have to guard your character. If you sit there and assume your character, that you just got it all, you got all that figured and checked off, you're in dangerous territory. We're all one step away from being a crook. If you've ever heard Gordon McDonald's testimony on James Dobson's program, I was driving down I-85 from Atlanta to Gainesville when I heard it, and I broke out in tears. I said, if Gordon McDonald can be unfaithful to his wife after saying that's the one thing he wouldn't do, it could happen to anybody. We're all, if we don't guard ourselves, we can step over that line. It should be a battle. And have that support team around you. Courage, confront your doubts and fears. If you don't walk out of here with anything else tonight, I hope you'll remember, confront your doubts and fears. Lean into the pain of your fear to do what you know is right. Bounce back, be resilient. You're going to get knocked down. You need to help our young people go through some tough times and bounce back because they've been protected a lot. Competence. Clarify your culture. That's your job. Over-communicate the message. That's your job. Develop your people. That's your job. Balance mission and people. Reisner, Denton, and Stockdale, they were all about the mission, but they gave their heart for the people. Just like David Green was talking, and all of you know that. We have to balance mission and people. We got to do both. We can't just do one or the other, even though most of us are wired up for one or the other. We're not going to have any questions tonight, but I want to close with one the quote. This is from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Return of the King, and this is on the screen in the trailer. You can go to the internet and find it. It says, there's no freedom without sacrifice. There is no victory without loss. And there is no glory without suffering. The Olympic athletes suffer to win. Christians have to suffer to win. If you're not suffering to be a good husband, if you're not suffering to be a good wife, if you're not suffering to be a good leader or a good father, you're not doing your job. Because the reality is, to live the Christian life, it is about suffering, crucifixion, and death, and then resurrection, frequently. And I want to add one last one to that. I'm taking author's liberty here. I want to add one more. There is no honor without courage. You cannot live and lead with honor without courage, because fear and doubt will take you out. I'll be out signing books out there. Please check us out on Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn. I'm already connected to a lot of you on LinkedIn. I do write blogs. I've got one coming out on honor here next month. I just had one come out on succession planning, but I hope you'll tune in and follow us on blogs. And do take your handout home. The 14 lessons are on there. It's been an honor and a privilege to be with you tonight. And so I'd like to call Walt up here. Walt has got on his t-shirt now. Walt, you look like you need some more reading material. You've been writing too many books, so I want to give you and Patty one of my books, Leading with Honor. And thank you for doing such a great job and getting us through here.
Thank you very much. Come on over here by the... Lee Ellis. That's very kind of you. There we go. Very kind of you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.